Voices in The Intercept. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. Most films will show at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, room 104 at PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the screening of the documentary film Big Money Agenda on Sunday, February 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Big Money Agenda explores the effects of money in politics, Citizens United, as well as solutions to the issues of money in politics that's preventing real change. There will also be a discussion after the film. Again, that's the screening of the documentary film Big Money Agenda on Sunday, February 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Supported Radio, and more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste is up next.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, your community radio station. And it is located at 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany, and via the World Wide Web, it is kboo.fm. And this is More Talk Radio. Today we are broadcasting, is Monday, February 11th, 2019. And this morning, we would like to expand on our discussion around Black History Month. And particularly, we want to have a conversation about the media emphasis, or a lot of media focus has been on the phenomena of blackface. Most recently, we heard it talk about the current political figures, the governor of Virginia, where it was posted on his medical school yearbook. And also remember, this is 1984. Was it 1954? People on his yearbook page, two people, one in blackface and one in a KKK outfit. The governor says, after first saying he apologized, he didn't say it wasn't he, and then he admitted that there was a time where he was in a dance contest and he wanted to put on blackface to resemble a pop artist, and all apologetic. There was certainly a call for him to resign, and now the latest I heard or read is that he's not going to resign, that this is possibly a teachable moment, as if we don't know what racism is or not. we're going to expand our discussion, but I thought it might be helpful as I reflected on the governor's reaction and how all of a sudden an insult to African Americans becomes all about the governor and his political career, and how he, the educated white hetero man, is going to teach us all about racism. And it reflected on an article I read some time ago in Yes Magazine by Shannon Barber. And I thought it might be interesting to read. It was an article in Yes Magazine in September, I think, 2017 was first posted. And it's titled, "Dear White People, Stop Making Racism All About You." And Shannon Barber writes, "When it comes to social media etiquette, we are still learning how to interact with each other while respecting boundaries in the space we give ourselves. What has translated straight from our in-person interactions are racist, sexist, ableist, micro and macro aggressions. How do we navigate those? How, well, it would help if people with privilege recognize the way in which they are routinely demanding labor from marginalized people online. In regards to white folks and their anti-blackness, here is a list of 10 ways that can stop annoying people of color on social media." Okay, get your listening ears on. So, number one, when we, and Shannon is referring to black people in particular, post about racism, like being called racist names, racial harassment, feeling about being called racist things, or being racially harassed, stop saying you're shocked. Don't say, "I can't believe this still happens." Don't tell us all the ways you are surprised, because you're either lying or haven't been paying attention. Don't show us how much you don't listen when we talk by carelessly stating shock. Think about what it says to us about how you see us before you say something. Number two, when we share whatever flavor of racial pain we are in, don't proclaim what a good white person you personally are and then go on to tell a story about the time you rescued a poor black child from the ghetto. We don't want to hear about that time you bought some jammy pants that gave 5 cents to an elephant in India or whatever. Just don't do it, because it's not about you personally unless you personally cause the problem. If you want to tell your story about what a wonderful white person you are, take it to your own space, because we're not here for it. Third, related to number two, say you come across a post on Facebook and there is a lengthy thread where people of color are going off about how terrible white people are. Don't be the white person to hashtag "not all white people" the thing. If you are personally offended by the quote stereotyping and in quotation generalizations of a group of people either sharing their pain or cracking jokes about whitey, calm the hell down. There is not a comment thread long enough. You, singular, good white person, cannot be the savior of whiteness. And fourth, Not all conversation need your stories about something tangentially related. For example, a group of black people on social media are talking about hair issues. Maybe we're talking about things like little black girls being threatened with suspensions from school for wearing their hair natural or wearing braids. Maybe we're talking about living in majority white cities and not being able to find certain products, whatever. Mind your own business. The time someone told a blonde joke that hurt your feelings, or the glossy lady rag article you read that says curly hair isn't serious, please don't insert yourself. Stay in your lane. Number 5. If you don't understand a black colloquialism, African American vernacular English, or other brown people slang, do not start yammering about the demise of the English language and how terrible slang is. AAVE, and that is African American vernacular English, is among the most vibrant and ever-changing dialects of the English language. So don't. If you don't understand, Google before you ask, or just deal with the fact that it isn't for you. Number 6, related to number 5, think about how you use African American vernacular English, AAVE. Do you use it when you want to feel sassy? If they only use for blackness, you have is to consume it and regurgitate it. Skip it. Quote Miley Cyrus or Katy Perry or somebody until blackness means more to you than 2 seconds of cachet or sash. And number 7, stop letting your white friends act like a-holes on your friends' posts. You don't have to be confrontational. You don't have to ride to the rescue. You can say to your friend, "This is not appropriate here. I am sending you a message so that we can talk." Handle your own people. And number 8, on things white people so stop making whiteism all about them. Number 8, if ignorance suddenly turns you into the sort of person who leaves 4 inches worth of comment on a Facebook thread where your police tone demanding emotional labor and refuse to do your own research, just stop. Your anti-black biases are making you receive our responses as aggressive thanks to racist tropes like the angry black woman. There's nothing gentle about racism, and our responses to it don't warrant subtlety or kindness in return. And number 9, don't ask us why we hate white people. Just don't. Please stop. Don't commend us if we decide to say not all white people. Don't demand to alight on you for being the one truly good white person. Number 10. If reading this list has you furiously writing up a long comment to explain to me how you're not the problem, how racism is bad, how I don't really know the struggle, if you're earnestly going to hashtag not all white women and or hashtag not all white people me, you ain't ready. If you believe this is directed at you personally, it definitely is. This article was originally published by Wear Your Voice. And it's an article by Shannon Barber and edited and published in Yes Magazine in September 2017. And again, perhaps it's appropriate Black History Month to remind ourselves white people, racism isn't all about you. Now, let me remind you that you are listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO. I am Cecil Prescott, and indeed, I do want to hear your voices. So, give us a call, 503-231-8187. We're talking about racism and responses on social media. What are the roles of white people in their responses? And in a few minutes, we're going to delve deeper into the recent social and media fascination with blackface, that horrible thing that happens, minstrel actions where people cover themselves with shoe polish or something. Actually started in the 1830s. A young, well, I don't know if he was young, but I believe his name was Thomas Rice, created this character, a blackface, a cartoon character, and actually named the character Jim Crow, as a way to make fun of, demonize, belittle, at that time, the suffering of slaves in the Americas, and it has certainly a long history. You may be familiar with one of the first great, unquote, films that was made, The Birth of a Nation, in the early 20th century. Again, having white actors portraying the demon-like black people, black men, and the rise of the KKK as the savior of white women, in particular, white people in general. This was a media popular media use of blackface, continuing into the first movie that with language talk. It was Al Jolson, the jazz singer, and he was in blackface. And it goes on and on and on, up until apparently medical schools in the 1980s. I thought it gave me a whole new perspective on medical schools. And, but apparently some people thought in the 1980s that it was still appropriate. And it continues onward today. 1993, Ted Danson went to
Friar's Roast, I think.
With his then girlfriend, Whoopi Goldface, and Black.
Whoopi Goldface.
Goldberg.
Yes.
Thank you. In blackface. So that this continues on.
Well, you know, the problem is that we are still not wholly perceived as worthwhile human beings by white society. And the majority of white society may say that it's only a small percentage of people who don't, you know, who are fearful, who are protective of the privileges they have built into white society. But the truth is that unless you are able to, as a white person, give up, uproot, ignore, not buy into the privileges that are built into white society, you're guilty. Mm. You're guilty. And people don't like being guilty. You can tell somebody, you know, I hear you talking about how bad drivers are, so I talked to the neighbors, and we're going to get cameras on our street, and we're going to get speed detectors on our street so that the criminals won't be able to slip past us fast. And you might think, oh, snap, I've talked myself into a corner here, because right. I'll be one of the first ones caught because I don't want. And then suddenly you think, you know, I don't want to be guilty. No, that's a bad idea. That's an invasion of privacy. You know, and I look at this whole idea of I'm the good person, and I want to encourage people to, rather than look at yourself and say I'm a good white person, look at yourself and say, how can I be a champion or an ally or a friend to people when I see racism and or discrimination going on? How can I run interference? How can I dismantle my privilege so that I can rest easy at night? And that's a challenge, you know. When I've done some of the anti-oppression work that I've done, especially when John Kanda, Judith Mowry, and myself did the Restorative Listening Project on gentrification, one of the things we did talk about was there is white dialogue necessary in discussing racism, but only in that the white people who are alive now have inherited that machinery, and because they've been trained in how to maintain that machinery, they are responsible for dismantling that machinery. That's the role. And when I was listening to you read the list, I was I was thinking, yeah, you know, these are valid points, but there's two different arenas in which the work needs to be done, and one joint arena. And that joint arena, I go back to and I say again, is how can you dismantle dismantle the machinery of institutional racism and its cousin bigotry and prejudice so that you become a strong ally to people of color?
That's a good question, too. To have some feedback on.
Yeah, and then with regards to blackface, that's part of the whole communal shaming, because by now, unless you live under a rock, you know that blackface is problematic. It just is. Even if you live, die, breathe, eat, smoke, wash Michael Jackson, you know, there's a point where if you want to emulate him, or you want to impersonate him, or you want to be seen as him, you might want to think, well, can I just do him but not put blackface on? You know, the moment you put on blackface, it has a historical weight to it that you may not intend, or you may intend, you just think you're going to get away with it.
It's just, it just reminds me, again, in terms of parallel universes that we live in.
Yeah.
So that I found out it was interesting to see that in terms of the governor of Virginia, that in 1980s, mid-1980s, it was in some places was okay to do that?
As far as white America is concerned, Now, I didn't say white people. I said white America with our imperialistic stance and importing white culture. It's okay to do it anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, right. It's okay to do it anywhere. But we want to hear what you have to say. And this is a topic. I have a book that I have intended to deal with, but it is strong, and I can only read little bits of it without having stomach knots.
Yeah.
But we are going to be working with the author on that. So this is not the only time we'll be dealing with this issue. 503-231-8187, and we'll go to Carolyn, who's been patiently waiting. Good morning,
Hi.
Carolyn.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a couple questions. First, I want to have a comment, and then I'll ask a question. First, I mean, one of the things is this is very important because I heard someone say before, I mean, to dismantle the systemic racism and systems that keep this horrified system that we have in place is by white people who are responsible for making the system. So it involves white people, so they need to be aware of this topic that it's very important to discuss. And then secondly, a lot too has to do with like culture or understanding of body language and culture. For example, within every culture, like if you don't have the swag or you don't know the body language or the eye contact of the social norms, it's difficult to fit in because you're uncomfortable or the people that you're trying to fit in with are uncomfortable because you don't read the same body language. So a lot of black people who were raised or who went to a privileged white school find themselves easily adapting and able to move up the ladder, not just because of their socioeconomical status, but because they were raised around the same cultural and the same body language. Does that make sense? The same social cues.
Well,
subtle and really difficult to define. And so the segregation that exists within our society, black people over here and white people over here, prohibits a harmonization or a general understanding of what the basic social cues and body language are. So
I would
segregation for the end, then we would understand each other a lot more and feel a lot more comfortable around everybody else.
I would argue that black people know a lot more about white culture and all of its strata than white people know about black culture, because
Amen.
That's what we see all the time. So
to say that
black people are not familiar with culture, body language, or white culture's codes would not be 100% accurate. You have people who are extremely light-skinned, and there's doubt about whether they have any African ancestry or not, who have talked about how racist people can get when they think there are no black people around. And so given that, I'm not sure of the validity of that statement, you know, you're making.
It's probably only a small part, you know. It's just time.
A small part of who?
A small part of like a much bigger problem. I mean, that's pretty multifaceted. It's so ingrained in the American country that it's kind of hard to escape. I mean, it's in every single aspect of our whole society, just from the foundations up, having been built on that slave genocide of Native Americans, and just the history that's taught in our schools has nothing to do with reality. Because I mean, I'm 46. I was 33 years old before I came to understand that there are indigenous languages spoken in Mexico, for example.
That's because Mexicans are Native American, and
yeah, I have no idea.
That should be taught, you know, just like Native indigenous people in Canada are Native American, you know, and we call them a different name and further isolate them from their historical ties to this landmass.
Yes, so I agree with you, Steph. I think people of color, African Americans and Native Americans, everyone included, knows more about the white social class than white people do about anybody else.
Yeah, that's so because that's all we're allowed to see.
Yeah,
you know, so unless there are tropes and stereotypes.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
The program is really important. And my one question that I hang up. Okay, as a white person, for example, wanting to learn more, or other white people who might want to learn more about different cultures, how do they approach those questions? Like, if I have a black friend, or I meet someone, or I see someone in the grocery store, or I want to make friends with a black person, how do I address the fact that I'm aware of certain things, or
well, are you know that,
that
is a that is a difficult
yeah
that's a difficult question to ask, in that you don't want to make that person you can't make that person the ambassador or the font of all your learning. It's best to involve yourself in multiracial groups and observe and listen. Observe and listen to what people say, and then show, you know.
Their perspective is the dominant perspective. They want to interject in everything. I appreciated that list that was read at the beginning of this program. You know, that's going to be a challenge.
Well,
here I am. Okay, I'm going to hang
okay.
Up.
Okay, well, okay, thank you. You know, to observe and listen, watch and listen, be quiet and listen, you learn. Watching television to understand what black people think is not going to help you. Maybe black-made movies might help to a degree, but it really depends on what studios they're coming out of, who's the producer and director, because then, you know, they're going to bend that movie to their will. Reading books is really helpful. Books by black authors. You know, I mean, you can pick up something historically relevant, such as books coming out now, like, for example, Becoming by Michelle Obama is a place you might start. You also might read some Zora Neale Hurston. You might read some Toni Morrison. I love Toni Morrison. You might read some James Baldwin. You know, I suggest you be in a nice quiet place to scream when you read James Baldwin. And who was the brother who wrote Native Son? Richard Wright. Yeah, Richard Wright, Native Son. You know, and the reason I suggest some of these books is that they deal with the horror that still raises its head now. It's not like racism went away and turned into something else. No, it's still here. It just has a new version, you know.
And you are listening to More Talk Radio here on Community Radio Station, KBOO. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. We are exploring racism and our responses to it. Let's go to see if Mike is still on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to expand that definition of racism a little bit. It's don't only include white people. I think there's other groups of people that some people identify as different racial groups, but they're racist too. And white folks classify them as being white, like Asians or Hispanics or people like that. They're considered white, and these people also are racist. So we can't just identify it as being white. Also, when we talk about racism, you know, you can transcend racism in this society through classism. And I think once you get in a certain economic group, I don't think you really find racism at the 1%. I think the 1%, you know, they're not dealing with racism.
Let me ask you about that comment, because some people would say, as you climb the economic and social ladder that you continue to have racism, but maybe differently.
Yes.
But it impacts you nonetheless.
I mean, we interviewed a man years ago, Ellis Coase, who wrote Rage of a Privileged Class, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And he was an editor of either Time or Newsweek, prominent black man. And when he continued to suffer from racism, as he's moving up the economic and the achievement ladder, it occurred to him he needed to capture the stories of people who were well off and wealthy. Even Oprah, you know, and I'm not necessarily an Oprah fan, but even Oprah said that she ran into issues of racism when she was trying to shop at stores, and they closed pretty much in her face and said, no, you can't come in.
Well, it's also, you know, the particular type of stores that wealthy Oprah can shop in. But
yeah, but even though she's wealthy, you know, there were constraints on her money. She couldn't spend her money like white people could spend their money, because the white stores that catered to rich white people wouldn't let her in. But go ahead, Mike. I want to hear some more about what you're saying.
Well, what I'm saying is, first of all, Jesse Jackson once said it real plainly. There's two different arenas out here.
Mm-hmm.
If you're dealing in the social arena, then you're dealing with racism and all the rights and wrong. But if you go into the political arena and being wealthy and being rich and have, it's about winning and losing. I'm talking about power. You know, I ain't talking. You got. I'm talking about power right now.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get into a position that you have actual power, then racism don't exist. And when you talk about black people, you know, there's African nations, there's black people that's outside of continental USA. You talk about world leaders that are black, and they don't deal with racism. So I'm just expanding your horizon right now and trying to get you out of America, the confines of America, and think globally. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, you raise a good point, but I would counter that racism can still raise its head when you are powerful, depending on the arena, even within the arena of politics. Because look at all of the stuff that the Obamas went through, and that was both prejudice, bigotry, and racism coming to bear. So I think
Obama, first of all, Obama's a puppet. You know, he's out. People that have power don't come out front. They're in the background. And so Obama was just a figurehead. He had no real power. So, and plus he didn't even have a lot of money when he went in there. He got rich while he was in office. But you know, one other thing, racism is also in medicine. You know, a lot of care that we get, a lot of prognosis that they make in the medical field, they base it on genetics. They base it on race. If you have a certain ailment, they say, well, that's peculiar to black people, so we don't need to go any further. So racism is even in medicine. And before I leave, I just want to say that, as I've always said, that PETA have done more work and have gained more social acceptance for animals than black people or certain people have gotten in society. I'll talk to you later.
Hey, thanks a lot, Michael. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm here to speak to that racism in medicine.
Well, yeah, I think he raises a number of points in terms of where how racism manifests itself. Well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Henrietta Lacks, Gila. I remember as a youngster studying science, and when I say youngster in this case, I mean in elementary school, my mom telling me about Henrietta Lacks.
Oh,
and the Gila cells were taken from her body. Yes. They were discovered to live and generate outside of her body, and those cells were used to make all kinds of vaccinations and medicines. Yeah. Now, her family lived in poverty and didn't even know that this had happened to their family member. And I will give this woman her due, a younger white woman who found out about it, and it pierced her spirit, and she went and found the family. She wrote a book about Henrietta Lacks, and that information is up there for us. Her family was left to suffer in ignorance and squalor. You know, no money had been paid to them at all, no attention paid to them at all, no health care, nothing. And so, you know, that's one of the examples of racism in the medical field. You know, not only that, you know, and Michael touched on this, but he didn't mention it specifically. Many medicines are made to operate and work on white males.
Yes.
And to a lesser degree, white females. Medicines are not always checked to see what their effect will be on Asians and Latins and Native populations and blacks and American blacks. American blacks are unique because I used to always say, you know, we are a new world race because we have everything in us. I still have problems with medical care because they make assumptions, and I have to tell them. When my sisters and one of my brothers came down, it finally manifested itself. Factor V, which is a blood clotting disease, the folks thought that they had made a mistake, but I had to explain to them, well, not everybody in my family was black. My father was half Irish and half Algonquin Indian. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's the carrier of the disease because he has European family. And so they don't pay attention. You know, we are also thought to not feel pain, so they won't prescribe pain medicine. It's a mixed bag.
Yeah, the manifestation of racism is across all fields, medicine,
yes,
literature,
politics,
education, politics, and media.
Finance, nutrition, name it.
Our numbers are 503-231-8187, and we'll go to
our next caller.
Our next caller on line one.
Hello?
Hi. I'd like to call about this blackface situation, and I think that the reason why they're getting away with so much of it is because of our acceptance of blackface wearers or people who loved seeing blackface on the money. These presidents on our money and everything, on our schools and rivers, if we accept them, and they were some of the main people pushing blackface, liking it. Mm-hmm. If we accept them, that's like saying it's okay. And I think, yes, a lot of white people see that. They know that these presidents and these monsters on the money are up to their necks in blackface, and how we just sloughed that on by.
Yeah,
like, because it's on days gone by. But there is an unconscious, subconscious acceptance of them doing it, and then when these people do it today, oh, it's all holy hell about it. I think until we correct those people at the source, those blackface loving presidents naming buildings and rivers and streams and schools after people who were doing it, if we can nip it in the bud there, maybe some of the triple up effect will correct people today. Because yes, you're right, people are still doing this today. I know people whose sons and daughters who are in their 20s and 30s who are doing blackface.
Mm-hmm.
And in interracial relationships, I'm talking about the interracial relationship, the person will find out that their mate's child is doing that.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes down to a personal level like that, that's when you have those conversations with folks and ask them, are they aware that this is a insult, and it's just seriously disrespectful, not to just you who might be there and see it, but to a whole group of people. I think sometimes subtly, people who ought to know better do it because, well, as one thing, as Mike says, they have the power and they want to display all the trappings of the power, but also because some of the people who do it nowadays want to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find it hard to believe that a governor would think that it's okay to dress up as a quote-unquote Katrina victim and putting on blackface, but that would be acceptable.
Power has these blind spots, like those people who did Breakfast at Tiffany's with Rooney there, with the Asian face and the buck teeth.
Mickey Rooney. Yeah.
Modern day and age, still doing that.
Well, that's because even the more we achieve as people, the more threatened the powers that be that support and depend on white supremacy, the more nervous they get, the more they respond with these virulent attacks. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of got to be prepared. I mentioned that there's a book that I want to discuss with an author. The name of the book is Watermelons, Nooses, and Straight Razors.
I want to write that down.
Okay.
But Celeste, you were on to something about that medical thing, too. I wanted to cap that. I am 65 myself, and I have run into that. They think we don't feel any pain. It doesn't matter whether it's dentist or whatever it is. We are not treated the same, and it really breaks my heart. Whether it's downtown at Central City or whether it's somebody you're paying cash to, we
yes.
always have to pay that tax. So thank you for having this show on, and I will continue to listen and support you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The caller, she mentioned in terms of the presidents, and I'd like to also emphasize that point in terms of these things are not developing in a vacuum. And the fact, I mean, we have this legacy on which this nation was built on in terms of the genocide of people and the enslavement of people. And as she suggested, those who were the leaders of the development of this nation were not only recipients but also those who were responsible for racism in our society. So until we get to that point where we can look at the people, as you suggested, on our paper money and actually ask the question, why do we honor those people? And then, you know, it's not only Confederate generals' statues we have to take down. You know, there's, you know, schools and monuments of Washington and Jefferson's that,
Well, I can tell you it's so deeply ingrained in the world. For example, we know that Rhodesia changed its name. It's now South Africa, but we still have Rhodes Scholars. That's right. Say it again.
Zimbabwe.
You're right. It's not South Africa. It's Zimbabwe. Rhodesia changed its name because it was named after Cecil Rhodes, and Rhodes Scholars still bear that name. But the book that I mentioned, that it's going to take me a while to get it together and have a show, is called Watermelons, Nooses, and Straight Razors, Stories from the Jim Crow Museum. The author is David Pilgrim, P-I-L-G-R-I-M. And I got it sometime last year during the summer, but it takes a lot of intestinal fortitude to get through, because when you see these tropes, you recognize how even some of our current TV shows and movies are still echoing that same attitude. You know, I watched Charlie's Angels because I needed something goofy to watch.
The 70s
the new,
TV show
no,
or the
new
movies?
One, the okay. new one, uh-huh. movie with Bernie Mac in it. And if that wasn't a step and fetch it character, I don't know what is. And, you know, it, 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 it might be celebrating female power, but it still denigrated the black man. And I just, you know, and I'm sitting there watching it, and it's like you're two people watching it. One person who's entertained by some, you know, eye candy in terms of blowing up and fights and mysterious intrigue uh-huh. and all that. And yeah. then the other person that says, boy, we just can't get a break, can we? We can't get a break. Why am I still watching this?
Movie.
I just wanted to watch something, you know. And wasn't it? No, it wasn't James Baldwin. Don't go away, don't go away. Name the black writer with the French name. I can't think of him right now. He came after Frederick Douglass, but not a whole lot after him. He wrote Faces in the Bottom of the Well.
Well, maybe
it'll come to me. It'll come
to you at one of our callers.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to our next caller, Michael. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. Were you trying to think of W.E.B. Du Bois?
Yes, that's exactly who it was. He spoke of us, and he wasn't the only writer, of having more than one consciousness, of being doubly two-minded, or double consciousness.
Yeah, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And that's how we have to function in this world, you know. But anyway, what did you call to speak about, Michael?
Okay, the article that Cecil read right at the beginning of the show?
Yes, from Yes Magazine.
That hit me, and I bet it hits a lot of people, white people I'm talking about. It's like a raised middle finger. It's hostile.
You think it's hostile?
Oh, man, is that hostile. And then, not only is it hostile, but then along with it comes a request, we want you to be our ally. We're going to raise a middle finger to you, slap you in the face, and then ask you for help. And I don't see why anybody thinks that kind of approach would work.
So let me ask you, why were you offended by the article in particular? What did you find offensive?
Why did you think it was hostile?
Shut up, stay in your lane, don't talk. We don't care what you think, we don't care what you feel. Basically, you're white, you suck, shut up and take abuse, is how that hit me.
Okay, now, did it ever occur to you that that was an apt reflection of what racism is? Did it ever occur to you that that was an apt, was the word I use, or appropriate reflection of what racism is? Because racism says exactly the same thing you do. It's trying to create some space for people to think.
So it's sort of like this bad thing is happening to us. We're going to do the same bad thing to you, sort of in the hopes that you'll develop empathy for us.
Michael, I think it's one thing to listen to something and the other to read it. So I would commend to you to read the article, and maybe we could go point by point, and you could highlight things that you found offensive or things you would like to debate on. Because, you know, it's a pretty long article with 10 points, and so it's somewhat, you know, I accept what you're saying, but I think we can be much more definitive in our discussion if we are able to go point by point. So I commend the article to you, and then I'll call back and we can go through the article and talk about it more.
Tell him where he can find it.
It's at Yes Magazine, and just use your search engine. The article is entitled "Dear White People, Stop Making Racism All About You," and the author is Shannon, Shannon Barber, Barber. Thank you.
I've read a lot of articles like that often leave me scratching my head, and I don't think it's so much that it's point by point. I just think that you can't slap me in the face and raise the middle finger to me and then ask me for help. I mean, it just...
Well, it's not asking you for help. Okay, that's the point, Michael. It's not asking you for help. If any help is asked that you help yourself to understanding what it means to treat another human being as you would want to be treated yourself. That's what it's saying. is saying, stop and look, don't make excuses, but you're doing this. And even if you think you're not doing this, you probably are doing this. And oh, by the way, unless you are actively dismantling the system, you are tacitly supporting the system. And
well,
that's what it's saying to you. I mean, if we had a little more time, I'd like to understand why you're offended when somebody is telling you, get the freak off my feet. Get your foot off my neck. Why is that offensive to you? Because that's what the article is saying. Get off of me. Now, I'm not aware that I have to be genteel and delicate when I'm telling a bully to stop bullying me, or when I slap them in the face because they slap me. I wasn't aware that those were the rules of engagement.
No, those aren't those rules of engagement. But when you say dismantle, you know, do your work, dismantle racism, all of that, that's asking to recruit some effort.
No, it's telling you start with yourself.
So, for example, when we share about whatever it's in our racial pain is, don't proclaim what a good white person you are. One thing the writer wrote. Not all conversations need your stories about something tangentially related. It gives example of people and how people of color, black people, might feel in certain conversations. So it's an ongoing discussion, and we can continue this at another point. But thank you so much for calling, Michael.
Okay.
Enjoy your feedback.
Yes.
We have Francis on the line. Francis, thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Well, hi. That conversation, I felt my adrenaline going way up and way down and way up during
mm-hmm.
the conversation, because the man should not be offended at all. What it would cause me to do is to reflect on how white privilege is still in my life in mm-hmm. so many ways that it isn't in other people. And I am offended when Qantas Hayes was executed 2 years ago Saturday on 82nd Avenue, an unarmed young man, 17 years old. That offends me to my core, that still can happen and people can think it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what offends me is that people don't talk about the fact that right next to that black-faced person was a man or a woman or whoever in a Ku Klux Klan outfit. And to suggest that this is just some innocent little picture is clearly ludicrous to me, that anybody could suggest that at all.
People will suggest stuff like that, Francis. They will suggest it to try to rock us back on our heels and shut us up, as if to say, you don't see this.
What is more offensive to me right now is that in Congress right now, Representative Omar is being accused by politicians, including Democrats, of being anti-Semitic, because she's bringing out the issues of these huge lobbies that are there for Israel, and she's talking about policy, not Semitism. She's talking about Israel's policy,
mm-hmm.
and that is allowed to occur right now in our Congress. These conversations are happening.
Yeah. Yes, that's
and
true.
When the representative, I forget her name, is it Detmer or something like that, they were having a debate or discussion, speeches about limiting protest
and Francis,
penalizing
we're about to go off
protest.
The air, so
anyway, it's happening in our Congress right now.
Yes,
we
it
can
is
talk about that picture, but yeah. We can talk about that picture all day long, but we need to be talking about what's happening right now in Congress.
Hey, thank you so
all
much.
Right. You guys take care.
Thank you, Francis.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who are available, there was a discussion in terms of so-called about these issues on Democracy Now.
Yes.
Go to it, listen to it.
And we'll post this article that Cecil have. We'll post it on our page at KBOO. So it's kblo.fm/, as one word, More Talk Radio. And you can also leave us messages there. And you can also stay tuned because we've got Omo Variety Hour coming up at 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock is Locust Focus. And 11 o'clock is Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott today. All this and more on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, February 11th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, a documentary filmed at two concerts celebrating Chuck Berry's 60th birthday. Again, that's Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, showing Monday, February 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Making Waves, Rebirth of the Golden Rule, on Monday, February 11th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Making Waves, Rebirth of the Golden Rule is an award-winning documentary film. The Golden Rule is the peace boat that promoted the end of nuclear weapons testing in the Marshall Islands. Again, that's the film screening of Making Waves, Rebirth of the Golden Rule, on Monday, February 11th, from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Buchan Hall at the First Unitarian